Today, I'm here with Jean Dalders. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, you did. You did.
Okay, good. And we're here to talk about his first feature length film titled The Blade Cuts Deep. Congratulations. This is a major accomplishment for anyone and something very, very few people can say they've done. So that's awesome.
Thank you very much.
The description of the film is many people want their 5 minutes of fame, but for some, it comes at the ultimate price, their life. So John Abbott is our narcissist host of infamous real crime show Lights, Camera, Kill, known for its lurid reenactments of the darkest trespasses. It has made him rich by exploiting pain and suffering. Yet while Abbott basks in shamelessly in the limelight, one victim has seen enough. Broken by his loss, the man has a burning thirst for revenge, and now he wants to make Abbott bleed. So that's a really good description.
Well, thank you. You know what? In all truth, if you had read that description about 2 months ago on IMDb, we realized that we actually gave away who the killer was in the description, so we had to update it.
Okay, so this isn't the description that you are giving out then.
This is the description we are giving out, but in the actual
Okay.
original description, we actually just blatantly said who the killer was, and we didn't, and
Oh.
we because we've been passing that around to other people, and I just copied and pasted into IMDb and then realized that I've just told everyone who the killer is, and that's kind of the point of the movie.
Yeah, you were doing your own spoilers.
Yeah.
I wasn't even going to mention, I'm not going to mention who the killer is.
Okay.
So we can keep that a secret.
Well, first of all, thanks actually for watching it, because when you've made a movie, and like you said just before we started doing this interview, that it or sorry at the beginning, that it's difficult making a movie, and not just the gruel, the effort that you put into actually shooting the film. It's difficult getting it's the logistics mostly, getting the people together, of finding the financing obviously is like the most difficult part. That's the difficult part, and then it's all these other things that come with it that are also very difficult, like getting it out there and getting people to know that it exists. But yeah, it's certainly a lot more difficult to get the money, and it's a lot easier to actually make the movie, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, the build up to anything, it's like, you work forever for this thing and then it takes 5 minutes out of your life and the rest of it is trying to get that to mean something, those 5 minutes of your life, when it's
Yeah.
really like a few, like a whole year or something, but what I mean.
Oh, well, that's it. But what I was going to say, sorry, is thank you very much for watching it, because myself obviously directed it, but so many other people who are actually in the movie and other people behind the camera put so much effort in. And we've sent the movie to people, and you can tell they haven't taken the time to watch it, but I know you did, because whilst you were watching it, you sent me a message, which is
Yeah.
cool. So I knew you were actually watching the movie.
Well, yeah, you gave me, you trusted me with this link and with this like insider view. And so I wanted to see it. And I love checking out indie horror. And I just went to an indie horror film festival in Orlando, Florida. And I got to see some other indie horror films. And I strongly b believe in supporting people's projects, especially at this level. And people are doing amazing things. And I watched your movie and there have been people who have sent me things that I've watched and I've said, I'm passing on that. No thanks, like no comment type thing.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed your film. So I saw that, sorry, you formed the production company in 2018, Barbara Green Digital.
Yeah, that's right.
And I saw that The Blade Cuts Deeper is your first feature length film, But you also directed two shorts before this. One's called Death is the Keeper of Secrets, and the other is Death is Not a Whisper.
So that's right. So I'll give you two quick things first. So Death is the Keeper of Secrets. It's actually a crime movie. It's not a horror movie, although it does have some horror elements in it. But what I like to think the most interesting thing about that movie is the title, because there's a film by Sergio Martino called Torso, which you may or may not have seen. I really like it. And in the movie, the killer, as he's walking up the stairs, he's whispering to himself, "Death is the Keeper of Secrets." It's over and over again. I always thought that's a cool title for a movie, so I stole it and used it as the title for my short film. And taught it, and incidentally,
You borrowed
Torso,
it.
that I
You
borrowed
borrowed
it.
it.
Yeah, I borrowed it. That's the correct way. And incidentally, as well, Torso is also one of the visual, aesthetic visual references for when I was making The Blade Cuts Deeper, like, because I really like it. So it's not story wise, it's got nothing to do with it, but visually, there are certain bits in it that I kind of borrowed to put into The Blade Cuts Deeper as well. And then Death is Not a Whisper is a horror movie, and that is actually the title of a my friend does music videos, and he showed me a music video one day, and it was a title, it was a lyric in the music video, and I thought, oh, that's a pretty cool title for a horror movie as well, so I'll borrow that and use that as the title too.
So I was able to find Death is the Keeper of Secrets on YouTube, but I wasn't able to find Death is Not a Whisper. I was able to find like little films, like little shorts about the making of it, but I wasn't able to actually find it. Where can you find that?
Well, it's not actually it's not publicly available, that one. So with the short films, I never really imagined that they would be watched by anyone. I actually used the short films as kind of tests to see how, if I did make a feature film eventually, what my style would be, but also just I was collecting a crew, because I didn't want to just make a feature film with a cast and crew that I'd never worked with before. So if you've watched Death is the Keeper of Secrets, you'll notice that actually the two main guys in that, both of them are in my feature. One of them's in it more than the other. That first short film I made really taught me, and taught me about scheduling, even though it was only a 4-day shoot, taught me about how to schedule something properly. It gave me more my producer hat, so I knew what I needed to do to schedule the logistics of everything. Then Death is Not a Whisper is more of a straight horror movie. It's a monster movie, and that taught me more about how I needed to work with the practical special makeup effects people. Like, when we made that short, we shot it, I think it was in 2 days, and I only gave them a very short amount of time to do the practical effects, and they turned out good. And it's not, and they could have been better, but that's not to do with the effects artist. That's to do with me not scheduling the shoot properly and not giving them enough time. So those two short films taught me a lot about, okay, well, now when I come to make my feature film, I know how much time I need to give to the special effects guys. So, I mean, The Blade Cuts Deeper was only shot in 12 days, and we ended up doing 2 days of pickup. So it's only a 14-day shoot altogether. But out of all those 14 days, I'd say 4 of those days were given to some of the big practical effects that are in the movie, because I knew I had to, because obviously, I'm a horror fan. You're a horror fan. We're watching horror movies because we want to see people get killed, so it's got to look cool.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the death scenes. There was definitely the practical effects were really good. I specifically I really enjoyed the first kill in the kitchen, and
Yeah,
that's all I'm going to
I
say about that one,
bet.
but that was definitely my favorite out of the kills. What was your favorite out of the kills in
It's that
that one?
one, because that's my kind of little tip of the hat to Lucio Fulci, because I'm a big Lucio Fulci fan, and that to me was my kind of zombie flesh eaters, the wood going into the eye, when the zombie's dragging their head. So that was, and also that's also my favorite kill in it, because you're seeing through the POV of the killer. So for most, we obviously we've got an actor playing what we referred to as the maniac when we were making the movie, but for that kill scene, we spent a lot of money on the prosthetic head and getting the cast, and I thought, I can't let the actor do this, and if he screws it up, I'm gonna get angry with him, and I don't want to get angry with him because it won't be his fault, because we only have enough money to do this once. So I ended up doing it. So just thought, because if I screw it up, I'll just be angry with myself, and that's okay. I don't mind being angry with myself. But it didn't. We didn't screw it up, and I got to do what I think is the coolest kill in the movie. So that's my
That's
favorite.
awesome. I noticed that you are all about community and bringing the community together with indie horror, and it's like a I saw the word nonprofit being used at some point. So how do you reach out to the community? Like what is the community like over there? You're in Liverpool, right?
Yeah, so I'm in Liverpool. Yeah, so the company I help run is called what we call in England a CIC, which is a community interest company. So yeah, the Glasta is not for profits. Obviously, we make money because people who work for the company need to get paid. But what that means is essentially at the end of the financial year, if we have money left over, we're meant to put it back into the community. So what I've been doing is, or we've been doing is, when we get to the end of the financial year, when we have some money left over, we go and make, say, a short film, and then we get people who have no experience in the movie industry but have always wanted to try it, and they can come along, and we'll, pay all their expenses, and they can get to shadow, if they want to work, if they want to see what the sound department's like, or the camera department. Funnily enough, I mean, it's not really funny enough, everyone wants to see what it's like in the special makeup effect department because everyone wants to check that out, obviously. So that really where the giving back to the community comes. But also we do make we've taken a bit of a backseat on that over the last year because we've been concentrating on the feature film. But for years leading up to the feature film, we also do videos for social enterprises, so kind of, or for charities in the UK. They still obviously pay us money to do them, but we do them at extremely low rates that other video production companies or film production companies can't do, because we also occasionally help get funding from government bodies because we're also a CIC, and sometimes we run classes to teach people how to use cameras and things like that, just giving back as much as we can. Generally, I chose to do it this way, one, because I'm a filmmaker and I like making films, but also even in this day and age where it is so easy to kind of get a camera because obviously technology is a lot cheaper nowadays, there are still people who come from backgrounds where they still can't even afford a camera that is easily affordable to a lot of other people. So it's about giving opportunities to people.
No, that's amazing. I love that you do that and you have classes and you let people on the inside. That's really great because there are a lot of people that don't want they won't have those opportunities unless you offer them. So that's great.
It's cool. I mean, hopefully moving forward, my plan, I mean, I don't know how long this is going to take, but once The Blade Cuts Deeper comes out, and I'm under no assumption that this movie is going to, make a lot of money, because it's quite a niche genre anyway. It's, not many people are, or not that they're not fans, just that I think maybe younger people these days aren't too aware of what a giallo is. It's kind of more my generation and a bit older. So sometimes I sell it as a slasher movie because everyone knows what a slasher movie is. But then depending who I'm talking to, if they're kind of older, I'll talk about giallos because they're more likely to know what that is. But if I essentially want the movie to show what the production company is capable of on such a low budget, so that we can try and get investment financing from people, so that we could do something along the lines of maybe open up, not a massive one, but maybe a small film school where people don't have to pay, and we're kind of financed in a way that, people who wouldn't normally have the opportunity to go to film school come and study with us for, say, a couple of months and at least learn the basics, and then, maybe they could go on to do other things after that.
Yeah, that's super admirable. I would go to your film school.
Oh, that's cool, man. You're accepted.
Application process. Just let me in.
No. You just gotta show up, really. That's about
Yeah.
it.
Yeah. So speaking of the giallo, I know in your notes it says in your director's statement you said that you have giallo tropes in there. They're incorporated in the film, and that's what you modeled the style from and the look and feel of it. What giallo tropes would you say are most prevalent in this film?
Well, definitely the black gloved killer. That's kind of one of the big things. Just a point of view, some quite a few point of view shots. Quite a few giallos used like heavy breathing. I didn't really want to go down the heavy breathing route with the POV shot, so I decided to use the heartbeat instead. So with, the heartbeat would increase or decrease depending on how excited or kind of calm the killer was. Unfortunately, the main one we're missing is the investigatory aspect, because simply the movie takes place roughly over about 4 to 5 hours, and that's not really enough time to introduce a bunch of people trying to figure out who a killer is. That would be developed over days and days
You could
within, within the movie.
always make a second one. You could have the Blades Cuts Deep too, and the way that the cliffhanger at the end, which I won't say anything, but it kind of leaves a gateway to investigating everything.
Oh no, completely. I mean, I'm more than open to doing a sequel, because I like the character of John Abbott, and I like some of the other characters in it as well. I mean, the movie, obviously you know this because you've seen it, but the movie opens up with an episode from the fake TV show. And if we were to make a sequel, the idea we've floating around the moment would be it would also open up with a fake episode of the TV show, but it would be relaying the events of what happened in the first movie, but through the eyes of, lights, camera, kill, the style that they do it. So that would be the idea. And then it would go into another storyline. But again, that will all depend on if people show any real interest in the movie. So we won't need much money to make it, because I mean, I don't know if I told you or if it says anywhere in the notes how much this movie cost, but
No.
I don't know what it is in US dollars. You'll have to Google this, the currency exchange, but the whole movie only cost £14,000 to make, so it's
Okay.
probably less than $20,000.
Oh, yeah. That's not a lot at all.
It's not for
That's.
what I mean. You watch the movie, and I think some people are surprised when I tell them the amount it costs to make this movie. It doesn't look like a $20,000 movie. I'll just round it up to $20,000. I'm not sure how much that actually is.
Yeah.
But it's to do with, I think it's only a 14-day shoot altogether, but there's a lot of planning that went involved. And also, I was lucky enough to, because I've made quite a few connections over the years working on other people's films and also doing a lot of corporate work, I brought in a lot of people who work for very, very reduced rates, and they're professionals, so you get a lot out of them. And it helps that a lot of the actors are quite seasoned in it, even though you won't know who the actors are, but some of them are working actors on TV in England, so they know what they're doing. You can throw them a script and we'll have a little conversation and we'll do a little bit of blocking, but they're off, they're ready to go. There were no rehearsals on this movie because we couldn't afford it, so it was a matter of I got my actors. We had a Zoom call, I think, once, talked about the background of the characters, and then I just let them go with what their interpretation was wanted to be. And then on set, it was mostly with Abbott actually, because John Tewitt plays the character of Abbott, and he would do something and I'd be like, no, you got to take it up a volume. He's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, it's we got to do kind of a caricature of this guy. He's got to be over the top. So I was always telling him, you got to crank it to 11, keep cranking it to 11, keep going, keep going, keep going higher.
Yeah, no, that's really impressive because it just speaks to the people that you had on your crew and the people that you picked, that you picked well, and you know the talent that you're working with, and so that's
Oh, it's
awesome.
yeah, it definitely helps. I mean, that's another benefit of the two shorts I did. All the my DP and my sound guy, who I consider to be my core crew, because they're obviously the most essential, not the most essential, they are essential crew, but they're the bare minimum you need to make a movie, really, is some the camera person and the sound person. And we know how we work together now from those two short films. So when it came to this, we were off and rolling. And then there are a couple of other people I'd worked with, or the cast members I'd worked with in some other short films, because I work as a cinematographer. So when I was on other shorts or other it's mostly short films I've done so far as a cinematographer, I kind of start talking to actors, and then I keep them in mind. I think, oh well, she'd be good. I work with Kristen. Kristen plays the character of Olivia. There are other actors in it though, like James Podmore is the person who plays the editor in the movie, and he was in Death Is the Keeper Secrets. He's been in everything I've ever directed, short film wise. I like to think of him as my Robert De Niro. He's always going to be there with me.
Yeah. It's, I think all the great directors, they have their key figures that they keep with them, and that's like their support, kind of like they're almost like a lucky charm to have that certain person there, make sure everything goes right.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It's nice. I mean, I think it's the same in any job, really. It's nice to be around people that you're comfortable with, and it's a good working environment. I mean, I always prioritize that. I mean, obviously, I want people to be good at what they do, whether they're in front or behind the camera, but I'll always prioritize a nice person who I can get along with over somebody who may be very talented, but it's a pain to work with.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Yes, no matter where, no matter what you're doing, that's true.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. I saw that AJ Ballard was also a writer on the screenplay. How much of his influence made it into the script, like with the two of you?
I'd say that Alex, AJ, his name is Alex. He just always goes by AJ when he does his writing, because he's a comic book writer before this.
Oh.
He actually wrote co he co-created and wrote a series of comic books in England that are really good to check out, called Slaughterhouse Farm. It's like a throwback to 80s style slasher movies, but done in comic book form.
Yeah.
I've known him since we went to high school together. He's a couple of years older than me, so he was a couple of years above me in high school, but we've known each other a long time. And he, I would say, is like 80% responsible for most of Abbott's dialogue.
Okay.
That's not the kind of dialogue that I would normally write. Stuff that not really the stuff that Abbott's saying, but the way in which he talks. He's very fa it's very fanciful in the sense that I'm not intelligent enough to write that dialogue. That's basically what I'm saying. I'm not smart enough to write that dialogue. Alex wrote it. I think it was quite shared, because Alex lives down in London and I live up in Liverpool, so there's about 200 odd miles between us. So I would write a bit, send to him, he'd look at it, he'd tweak it, send it back, and we just go back and forth. I think we started writing the script and September 2021, and then we had it finished by about April 2022, which it could have been done quicker if we were both in the same room together, but just going
Yeah.
back and forth. And it actually started as a short film, but we started writing so much, we were like, oh, I guess we're doing a feature film now, so we'll just do it as a feature instead. But yeah, he wrote most of Abbott's stuff. And then I'm more responsible for the visuals, the stuff that was going to be visual within in the storyline, so in the script. So when it came to the kill scenes, Alex had a hand in writing them, but because also my background is as a camera operator, cinematographer, and an editor, I knew visually how I was going to shoot and direct all this stuff, so I kind of took over with some of that stuff. But I say it was quite even, but I will say that he was responsible for most of Abbott's dialogue. I'm not going to take any credit for that.
Yeah, but that makes sense with your backgrounds. So,
He's a fantastic writer, and we're currently going back and forth at the moment about the next movie that we want to write together. We've got so many ideas and so many different genres. I mean, it's going to be horror, because all I want to do is horror. I mean, I like crime movies as well. I'd be very happy to direct a crime movie, but it'd be more like a Euro style crime movie, because I'm a big fan of Italian cinema. But if all I not that if all I get to do, but if all I do is make horror movies for the rest of my life, I'm quite happy being pigeonholed as that. That's fine.
So I saw that you like Dario Argentino, or no, Argento. I'm saying that wrong.
That's
Dario
okay.
Argento, who made Suspiria. And I feel like that, like, there was a remake of it recently. And so I feel like the younger generation is kind of ready to embrace that kind of film now, just because that came out and everyone really embraced it. And I really love Suspiria and like the original. And I've delved into, like, as I'm doing this podcast and things, I've delved in some more of like the giallo. Like, I didn't realize Black Christmas is def technically a giallo, I think. Would you
I think
say?
some people, well, I think some people, well, it's certainly a precursor to slasher movies, because obviously I think a lot of people would say that Halloween is the first slasher movie, but then obviously Black Christmas came out in, I think, 1974. So you could say, no, it predates Halloween. But then again, you're right, Black Christmas does have a lot in common with, kind of, you could say that Bob Clarke, who made it, maybe may have been influenced a lot by Italian cinema and the giallos that were coming out at the time, because, he would have probably shot the movie in like 73, and it came out in 74. And 73, that's still the height of that's the height of giallo movies. So they, Argento made giallos big internationally, I think, in 69 or 70 when his first movie, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, came out. And then after that, you've got an influx of all these movies probably coming into the US. And although Bob Clark is Canadian, but and probably up there as well in Canada. So yeah, I could agree that Black Christmas can be considered a giallo movie. And you know what, maybe as well, simply because they've got quite a favorite who pops up in quite a few giallo movies, like John Saxon is in Black Christmas, and he popped up in quite a few Italian movies, and that's always kind of one of the actors that they would get to be in their films.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a connection there. The point of view, so POV, your use of POV is a great way to keep the suspense going. It's definitely one of those tropes of the giallo genre. And you always know, like you can guess who the killer is, but you're never sure. You could be wrong. So it
You
kind
could
of
be.
keeps you guessing throughout. When it comes to the POV, is your intention to keep the audience guessing?
Yeah, well, because there was no investigatory aspect in my movie, I wasn't really bothered if people could work out who the killer was early on. I was more concerned with, are they going to enjoy the characters that are in it and the kills that come. If I had gone down the route of making a pure kind of jelly where there was the investigatory aspect, then I probably would have thrown a lot of red herrings in there to, kind of make you think it was somebody else. But no, it's not really, it doesn't bother me if people work it out quite quickly. And I think without giving too much away in the movie, it fits the movie if you do know who the killer is quite quickly, because when it's hard to say this without spoiling something from the movie, when the main character does find out who the killer is, he doesn't really care. He doesn't really even think about it, because he to him, the person who's doing these killings is it's inconsequential to him. He's more concerned about himself, and I just want you to be concerned with what's going on in the movie and not really who the killer is. So if you work it out quickly, that's cool. If you don't, there's a you can find out at the end. But hopefully you just enjoy the stabby stabby stuff that goes on in the
Yeah.
movie.
No, and those scenes are filmed like beautifully. They
Oh, thank
definitely,
you.
I was very impressed. And then to hear you talk about the budget, I definitely would not have assumed that that was the budget. That's so
Well,
very
you
low.
know what? You know what the thing is, right? I've worked on quite a few other people's movies now, and there are other movies that I haven't been able to work on because I start talking to directors especially, and they're so concerned with what equipment that you have access to or what equipment you want to use, instead of being more concerned with how they're going to make the movie, that you don't need all this fanciful equipment to make a good movie. You just need to have some creativity and have a basic understanding of the setups and how you can do that. So you can achieve the look of the giallo or a slasher movie with very minimal lighting and very minimal equipment and not using the best cameras, just as long as you know how to manipulate people and create tension.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of people overemphasize the quality of certain items when really you should be looking at the creativity of your team, because if you have a creative team, they're going to make it work no matter what.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just got to look at some of the classics of horror movies. I mean, but the most recently, say the Blair Witch Project, look, that was filmed for a very low budget, but it's a great movie and did very well. I go back to 1974, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Okay, granted, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was actually made for more money than what most people think it was. I think the budget for that was something like $400,000 in the end, which is probably like 1.2 million now, which is not a lot of money, but it's still. It's a lot more money than I had to make my movie. But then again, we have the benefit now of technology on our side, with we can get a better picture quality with cheaper cameras, and we can get cheaper lighting. We don't have to use these massive expensive lights. We don't have to rent a lot of stuff. It's quite cheap to buy a lot of this stuff now. So, but yeah, I still think that a lot of people, a lot, it's more, I'd say it's more first time directors. I mean, first time directors for like short films, they're the ones that obsess over, oh, we're using a Red camera or an Arri. I'm like, well, and they're always obsessed with, well, it has to be Netflix approved. And I say to them, well, is Netflix financing your movie? No, then why do you care if it's Netflix approved? If you make the movie and it does well, Netflix will take it. The only reason they have Netflix approved cameras is when Netflix are actually financing the movie and they want you to use these cameras. So it's I think the energy goes in the wrong direction with a lot of people, and they have to be steered back to be like, just concentrate on the script and what you want to achieve, and let me do my job as the cinematographer. Let the sound guy do his job creating all the sound stuff for you. Let the makeup guys or gals do their job. Just concentrate on, you're the director. Or you're ahead of every department, and you just simply need to tell people what you want. Then the people you've hired will just go out and get it done for you, and then that's all you need to do.
Trust the experts, I think,
Yeah.
is the
Oh.
message there.
Yeah.
And so
Yeah.
many
Sorry.
people
Yeah.
don't. So many people
Yeah.
are
That.
like questioning the experts in a lot of fields. I think
Yeah.
that's a lot of our problems right now. Sorry,
I think
that's
so.
not the
No.
point
No.
of this at all, but.
Well, no, it does carry over to other industries too. It's a lot to do with insecurities about yourself, I think, and about, you're not 100% sure what you want, so you're trying to push your energy onto something else, and that can be in any industry, not just the movie industry.
Okay, so I find the premise of the whole film to be very interesting commentary on the way society treats true crime. And we tend to be dismissive of the people that have survived their loved ones, the trauma that they went through in losing a loved one, and then how exploitative the true crime industry actually can be. So I found that very interesting in your film. It kind of makes you grapple with some of these ethical dilemmas when it comes to true crime documentary. And true crime documentaries are at their all-time high right now, and they've
Oh,
ruined
yeah.
people's lives. They definitely There's lots of evidence that with what was the Don't Fuck with Cats? There was like a guy that was accused of being the one who killed the cat, and he ended up committing suicide.
Oh,
And there
geez.
are a lot of other cases too where people's lives have just been ruined over this stuff. Is there any specific case that influenced this, the script?
No, it's more the true crime aspect came because that was, I thought, would be fun to make that TV show Lights, Camera, Kill. It's more realistically a commentary on, I guess, content creation in general. And I don't think there's a bad thing for lots of people to make stuff and put it out into the world, but I think the problem is a lot of the time is that with certain things, and I see it because I have a son, he's 7 years old, and sometimes I walk in, he's watching YouTube, and look, he's actually quite sensible for his age, but obviously he'll watch a video, and whoever's on the video will be purporting facts about something, and I'm listening to him, I'm like, no, that's not a fact. I know that's not. I know for a fact that is not a fact. But he's 7 years old. He doesn't understand that. So it's the fact that anyone can just go on YouTube and have a show if you want, or make videos and start saying stuff. And some people don't fact check anything.
We know
And they
that
can get away.
more than
Yeah.
most in America right now. Sorry.
Well, yeah.
I'm
No, I think
like
you do. But that's the point. It's like, this guy in the movie, he's making a show about things, yeah, that have really happened within the world of the movie, but obviously he's sensationalizing it for profit, and he doesn't care about other things. He just wants attention. He just wants eyes on him, and it's that's kind of, I guess, my critique in a way on a lot of the content creators, is that they're just churning stuff out so quickly that they're not putting any real care and attention into what they're doing. And I think, although it may not be intentional, it can be destructive, and it can be dangerous.
No, it can definitely. I think we're kind of dealing with the backlash of that right now in society, and the way that information is spread. and these bubbles that we've created within our own, sphere of the internet, and like the biases that we have and confirmation bias and all this stuff. And yeah, it's definitely a problem.
It is. It
Definitely a
is.
problem.
I think one of the. I don't know. We've gone to this now, but I think one of the worst things that has happened is, unfortunately, the creation of the web. Not the internet itself, but the web. Because although it's a really good idea, we're obviously not using it for its best intended purpose because we're human, and humans never do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a way to connect people, which is nice because, I'm over here in Orlando, Florida, and you're all the way in Liverpool, somewhere in Liverpool.
Yep.
And, without the internet and the wide web, we wouldn't be able to do this. So it's really nice in how it connects people, but it also has the ability to separate us as well, with the content that we take in and all kinds of things. So, and yeah, I just, as someone who, like, I enjoy horror, and horror often emulates life. You get it from somewhere. And like one of my sayings is, on my podcast, is that the true horrors are often a lot darker than the horror that you will see on screen.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, even if it's not as horrific in it's like visually what's happening, it's the fact, it's more the impacts are completely horrific that has on the people around them or to the person itself.
Okay, so I actually had a little comment in here about the getting the emotion on camera, but you kind of already addressed that when you talked about telling the actor to like keep pushing it and to have Abbott keep pushing it and get a little bit more ridiculous, and not
Yeah.
ridiculous, but
Oh, it can
he,
be at times.
to be a very extravagant narcissist that, yeah. Do you, so I had a question, like, do you know anyone like that? Is he kind of modeled off of someone that you've worked with?
Yeah, he's modeled after two people. He's a combination of two people. So one person that I know, and then one person that Alex, the other right, the my co-writer knows. We're not going to say obviously who these people are because one of them's
Yeah.
actually quite powerful.
Oh. Well, I won't
yeah, so
ask
the
you that
yeah,
question then.
so yeah, but it's a combination of two people that we put together and then took it up a notch a little bit further. But some of the stuff that he does and some of the stuff that he says to people is stuff that I've heard this person do and say to other people, which is ridiculous when you think about it.
Yeah. No, it's he is a very good protagonist in the film. Or he's more of the antagonist, actually. He's not, I see him as the villain of the movie.
Thank you. You know what? In my eyes, he is the villain. I mean, obviously, the maniac going around is not a nice person. He shouldn't be doing that. But
Yeah.
in my eyes, Abbott is the true villain of the movie. And yeah, I agree with you on that one. And thanks for saying that. I think you're the first person to say that to me, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have no fuck. Sorry, I don't know if you curse your thing.
No, yeah,
I curse.
go ahead.
You don't have sympathy for him when he, well, I don't want to say anything, but there's no sympathy for him. He's a really bad person. He's a complete narcissist asshole to everyone that he works with. No one takes it. You can tell that they're all just like over his shit. They don't care about his opinion. It's more like silencing a child that's having a tantrum.
Yeah, oh no, completely. Yeah. I mean that was the way I wanted it to be. I didn't want you to like him. I didn't want him to go on some kind of arc where by the end of the movie you're like, oh, poor Abbott. I was like, no. As he goes on, he should get worse and worse and
Yeah.
worse.
And he does. He does get worse and worse and worse. And yeah, so good job with that. It
Thank
was
you.
very good. Yeah, I think, like, when it comes to my questions, that's about all that I had, unless there is there anything else that you would want the audience to know? Or actually, so before we got on mic, you talked about when it's being released. So you're going to have your first screenings of the film. Do you want to speak on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, sure. So the first screening of the movie now is going to be on March the 2nd of this year, 2025, at the Evansville Horror Convention in Indiana. It's playing on, that's the Sunday, March the 2nd, yeah. I think it's playing around 7. Maybe, no, it's playing on Sunday. I can't remember the time exactly. Then the next screening will be on April the 13th at the Haywood Horror Convention in Manchester, which is in the northwest of England. That's only about 30 miles from where Liverpool, from where I live. And then we're in talks with a couple of other horror conventions to get the movie on there in some places in the US. And then there's a cinema in England called the Leigh Film Factory who are interested in showing the movie. But the thing is, it hasn't been officially certified yet. And in England, you can show an unrated movie at the cinema, but you
Okay.
have to go to the local council and talk to them. So we're having to talk to them. And then I'm in talks with another cinema in Cardiff, which is in Wales, a cinema there to get a screening. So I'm trying to organize my own almost like cinema run in the UK. But it's difficult and it's a lot of work, especially when it's a micro budget movie, a horror movie, indie horror movie where the people in it, without sounding nasty, nobody really knows who they are because although they are working actors, they're obviously not big name actors. So trying to convince people to show is the thing. I'm in talks with some distributors at the moment that are interested in the movie, but that's just still early days yet. We may end up going down the self-distribution route ourselves because it is actually quite easy to do that nowadays. But yeah, sorry to answer your question because I ramble a lot sometimes.
No, you're good.
March the 2nd is the first official screening in Evansville in Indiana.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on like the doing producing your first movie full of fixture length. No, my words are jumbling. Your first full feature length film.
Thank you.
I'm going to cut this out.
Well, I gotta say, don't feel bad because my wife was kept asking me, "Don't you have an interview today?" And I kept saying, "Yeah, it's on the screen, like Scream." And I couldn't. And your title of your podcast was like a tongue twister for me. I couldn't say it. I couldn't tell what it's called.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone on that, but I hope I wish you the best, and I hope that you get a good response when it comes to screening the film and everything, because it's a really good film. The quality is great, the cinematography, the audio, the sound is really enhances everything in the experience. The kill scenes are great.
Thank you.
Lots of blood, lots of gore. So I think it's, and I really like the storyline as well. I think
Oh,
it
that's cool.
is a more unique, like I haven't seen that storyline be used in a lot of horror movies. So I really enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you. And I mean, and if anyone watching is interested, they can actually go to the movie's website, thebladecutsdeeper.com, and you can sign up for a newsletter there, and you'll get information about the movie. And we send out things early than we release publicly. And also, obviously, if there are any showings happening, that you might end up finding out that there's a showing near you at some point. If you're interested in going to see, I'll tell you what we are doing, which will be fun. We're gonna do a limited release of the movie on VHS. So some
Okay.
people still collect VHS, so we're gonna do a limited release on VHS. So we're not sure exactly when that will come out, but I think we might have some for sale by April when we do the comic convention, just and sell a couple of unrated VHS tapes to people. And there's gonna be hopefully a special surprise. We're adding an actor technically into the movie, not really into the movie. There's gonna be an introduction by a famous horror actor that I've met that hopefully will do it. To be honest, I haven't actually asked him yet, so he might say no. But if he does, he'll be on it.
Well, I hope that he says yes. I'm sure he'll
He
say yes.
will.
If he watches the movie, I think he'll be impressed and I think he'll say yes.
I hope so. I hope
But
so.
I love
Otherwise,
the
it's good.
idea of doing it on a VHS because, you know, any like true horror like nerd, that's what they collect is VHS.
Oh
So
yeah. Oh yeah. I
that's
mean,
great.
my visual effects artist and executive producer on the Bleak or Steep, his name's Guy Pearson. He's an unbelievable visual effects artist. He gave me a VHS of Assault Precinct 13, I think, like a month ago. So that's been added to my collection, which was really nice.
Nice. I say geek in the nicest way possible. I
No,
am,
I mean,
yeah.
loser. It's fine. I'm a loser. It's all right. I
No,
don't mind being a loser.
no, 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 not at all, not at all. Yeah. Well, I think that's all I have for now.
That's
Yeah,
cool.
it was great meeting you.